Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Melanie reading the Big Bend Sentinel, October 7th, 2020. Viral video captures local fault lines on masks by Stephen Paulson. Tri-County. A majority of Americans see face coverings as a common sense safety measure and courtesy during the coronavirus pandemic. In a recent poll from Morning Consult, 74% said they always wear masks when they leave their home. Likewise, around 60% of Americans said they had more favorable views of those who wear masks versus those who do not. But a vocal minority sees the issue otherwise. Instead of viewing masks as an affront to personal liberty, a viral video from Alpine last month is capturing those fault lines in the Tri-County. The video, which started making the rounds on Facebook last month, shows university police attempting to escort Jimmy Lipbaum, a former Sil Ross State University professor, out of the Sil Ross Rodeo. Lipbaum, who is not wearing a mask in the video, accuses the police of assaulting him. "I have every right in the world to knock you out," Lipbaum tells the officers as they try to remove him. But to the protests of Lipbaum's family members, at least three officers take hold of Lipbaum and try to escort him out. Lipbaum did not respond to requests for comment on the incident, but as the video gained traction on social media, some residents jumped to his defense, accusing officers of mistreating Lipbaum and questioning the efficacy of masks. Lipbaum, who at one point joined those social media conversations, said he was particularly upset because the incident happened on public property rather than at a private business. "Requiring people to wear masks," he wrote, "is tyranny and a violation of the Constitution." Some residents said that because the incident happened at a rodeo, masks should not have been required in the first place. That's not quite accurate. While Governor Greg Abbott's emergency orders do make exceptions for rodeos and similar events, those exceptions apply to crowd sizes, not mask rules. In health guidelines provided ahead of the event, Sil Ross State University emphasized the requirement for masks, stating in the event announcement, "Face coverings were required to be worn by all attendees," and further writing, "Due to Governor Abbott's health protocols, every person in attendance, NIRA members, vendors, coaches, ticket holders, etc., will be required to wear a face mask, except for when eating, drinking, or competing." Still, it's understandable why some Texans are confused by mask rules. After all, state leaders have almost gone out of their way to make such rules as confusing as possible. At first, cities and counties like Alpine and Brewster County were allowed to establish their own mask rules. Then Governor Greg Abbott reversed those rules, banning local mask requirements. As coronavirus case counts climbed across the state, Nelson Wolf, the county judge for Behar County and San Antonio, tried a loophole. Instead of requiring residents to wear masks, he required businesses to require customers to wear masks. Many observers expected those rules to be overturned, but Governor Abbott, to the surprise of almost everyone, said such rules were authorized and part of the plan in place all along. As Texas Monthly put it, Governor Abbott was treating his mask rules like a riddle for officials to solve. Countless other cities and counties soon jumped on what would become known as the mask loophole, including Marfa and Brewster County. Finally, in July, Governor Greg Abbott established mask rules across the state. He allowed counties with 10 or fewer active cases to apply for an exemption, but so far, at least, local officials across Tri-County have not opted to apply for one, as active case numbers have oscillated above and below the threshold. Sil Ross, for its part, said the incident was simply a matter of enforcing university policy. "The university has a mask-required policy for all university facilities at all times," a university spokesperson said in a statement about the video. "And while there are limited expectations, including when proper social distancing can be maintained, those exceptions did not apply to the school's rodeo." The school declined to otherwise comment on the incident, including to provide any police documentation. The university said that masks were required at the rodeo and workers were providing masks to anyone who needed one. Authorities file first charges in alleged Dollar General theft ring case by Stephen Paulson. Presidio. More information is starting to trickle out about an alleged theft ring involving both Dollar General locations and Presidio. In court filings on Monday, authorities formally charged several people involved in the alleged thefts. Previously, the Big Bend Sentinel reported that at least 9 people had been arrested over the alleged thefts. That included 4 store employees, Gazelle Andrade, Ramona Lujan, Zaneta Olivas, and 5 other people, Clarissa Acosta, Marcela Garcia de Galindo, Rogelio Lujan Jr., Julissa Perez Serrano, and Jose Macario Torres, according to Presidio Police. Monday's filings also gave a 10th name, Ada Acosta Caballero, a 35-year-old who will face misdemeanor theft charges, according to court filings. But public records from Chihuahua State, which list an Ada Clarissa Acosta Caballero in Ojinaga, suggest she may be the same defendant initially named by Presidio Police. The alleged thefts happened over the summer, and Presidio Police arrested most or all of the defendants in August. Online postings from the Presidio County Sheriff's Office from around that time also confirms those arrests, though those posts just say the defendants were arrested on theft charges and do not indicate that the defendants were allegedly part of a larger scheme. But with authorities at the time still investigating the alleged crimes, it wasn't until September when Presidio Police confirmed more details on the incident. In a news release that month, police said they'd first started looking into the matter of July after receiving a tip from the district manager of the local Dollar General stores. In a call to police, that employee expressed concerns that workers were taking part in and facilitating the theft of merchandise. Police stated in their news release, after an in-depth investigation, police confirmed what was already reported and started making arrests. So far, only 5 people, Ada Acosta Caballero, Marcela Garcia de Galindo, Rogelio Lujan Jr., Julissa Perez Serrano, and Jose Macario Torres have been charged in the case. But in an interview Tuesday, Rod Punton, the county attorney for Presidio County and the prosecuting attorney in this case, said more charges were likely coming. There are still investigations into potential other charges against other persons, Punton said. Of the defendants who have been charged, Acosta Caballero and Perez Serrano are each facing 2 Class B misdemeanor theft charges involving alleged thefts on July 14th. Lujan Jr. and Macario Torres each face 2 Class A misdemeanor theft charges from the same day, while Garcia de Galindo is facing 2 Class A theft misdemeanor charges from August 26th. The defendants charged with Class B misdemeanors are accused of stealing more than $100 but less than $750 worth of merchandise from Dollar General, while those facing Class A charges are accused of stealing more than $750 but less than $2,500 worth of merchandise. Ponton, citing the active criminal cases and investigations, declined to offer more information on these specific charges. But in general, he said, when defendants face 2 of the same charges from the same day, it's because multiple events happened, meaning authorities believed each of these defendants committed multiple thefts during separate incidents. Still, there are plenty of open questions about the case, including whether any alleged members of the theft ring will face more serious charges, like charges of conspiracy, if there were specific organized agreements to commit the thefts, or felony charges in general. In its initial news release from last month, the Presidio Police Department said that some of the defendants would likely face felonies. But Ponton, the county attorney, said he believed he was now handling all of the charges. And Ponton only prosecutes misdemeanors, not felonies. The local district attorney's office, which does prosecute felonies, could not be immediately reached for comment. Presidio Police did not respond to requests for comment by press time. Walk Across Texas aims to get residents moving and competing by Big Bend Sentinel. Presidio County. A new initiative aims to get Presidio County residents in the habit of walking and exercising more regularly. Even better, there are prizes. The free 8-week initiative called Walk Across Texas, or WHAT, will be hosted by Matt Linsane, the County Extension Agent for Presidio County. The goal, she said in an email announcing the program, is to help Texans establish the habit of regular physical activity while also competing for prizes. Here's how it works. People who are interested in competing form teams of up to 8 people. As an example, same listed the Marfa ISD teachers team, the Presidio ISD cross country team, and the Presidio County Courthouse team. The opportunities are endless for creating teams, Sane wrote. Teams then log their miles and compete to see who can walk the most. At the end of the 8-week period, there will be prizes for the top 4 teams. In her email, Sane left those prizes as a surprise rather than listing them. People can register for the program at howdyhealth.org. Because the leagues are divided among youth and adult participants, each group needs the league code for their division to register. For adults, that code is WAT L-200923-99337. For youth, it's WAT LY-200923-82048. For those interested in learning more, Sane will be hosting an orientation meeting at the Presidio County Courthouse lawn in downtown Marfa on Sunday, October 11th at 3 p.m. Sane says she will ask participants to sign a COVID-19 screening form and to also practice mask and social distancing rules. I will be taking all precautions that I can to keep everyone safe, she wrote. Sane says residents can also learn more information about the program online. She directed people to the social media profiles for Presidio 4-H. Their Facebook page is at www.facebook.com/Presidio 4-H extension, and their Instagram is at www.instagram.com/Presidio 4-H extension. People can also visit the website for Walk Across Texas at fch.tamu.edu/program/physical-activity/.
Hello, this is Cindy reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, October 1st. Woman Dies in Fort Stockton House Fire by Nathan Hewer. A 78-year-old female, Pascuala Nunez, was killed in Fort Stockton on Monday evening when her house caught fire, according to Fort Stockton Volunteer Fire Department Chief Jesse Dominguez. Nunez was taken to Pecos County Memorial Hospital, where she was pronounced dead. The other resident of the 1600 North Nelson Street home was treated for smoke inhalation and later released from PCMH. 2 firefighters were injured while fighting the fire. Both were treated and released from PCMH later in the evening. The cause of the fire is still under investigation. The fire station was notified of the fire at 7:05 p.m. on Monday, September 28th, and had the flames under control by approximately 9 p.m., according to Dominguez. Fire crews, the Pecos County Sheriff's Office, the Fort Stockton Police Department, and Pecos County Emergency Management Services left the scene by 1 a.m. The house was not salvageable, according to Dominguez. Mission Service. Apostolic Tabernacle Church embraces various cultures through mission service, by Nathan Hewer. The Apostolic Tabernacle Church in Fort Stockton held its first ever mission service on Sunday, September 27th. Members of the congregation dressed in various attire from a country they chose to represent. Following the Sunday worship service, members of the church presented their selected countries as projects via poster boards and by having various items from that country available to sample or see. The idea to have such a service surfaced by other churches doing similar events, which Apostolic Tabernacle Pastor Kevin Johnson observed over the past several years. I've been to them at other churches. I just decided I wanted to spiff it up and do a little bit more. We did the costumes, not just the Mission Sunday, Johnson said. The purpose of holding such a service was to enlighten and open the minds of the church members and those in attendance to various cultures across the world. It gives them the knowledge, the culture, and everything else, Johnson said. They're learning. How much is there, how much is allowed as far as the Bible, teaching, the church, religion. To end Sunday service and presentations of approximately 18 different countries, church members also brought food from their respective countries. They each choose for all in attendance to try. Some of the countries that were represented by church members included India, Korea, Dominican Republic, South Africa, Philippines, Mexico, China. Moving forward, Johnson intends for the Apostolic Tabernacle Church to have a mission service once every year. This will be an annual thing from here on out, he said. Next year we'll grow and have more giveaways. They'll catch on. It'll get bigger and better. FSISD employee tests positive for COVID-19. Active case number more than triples in past week, by Nathan Hewer. COVID-19 active case numbers in Pecos County was at just 6 people on Tuesday, September 22nd. That number more than tripled this past week as numbers climbed to 22 as of Tuesday, September 29th. One of those cases is an employee with the Fort Stockton Independent School District. FSISD Superintendent Ralph Trainum gave the news at the monthly school board meeting on Monday, September 28th. We had one case, and that came on Friday, September 25th, he said. We had 8 cases today, Monday, September 28th, and one of those 8 came back positive. No known cases have derived from the employee testing positive as of Monday. Out of the 19 additional positive tests over the past week, 8 cases were from unknown contractions, 7 were from potential travel, and 4 were from contracted from confirmed cases. The age range of those 19 individuals varied from 7 years old to 94 years old. The 94-year-old was the lone case out of the 19 that was hospitalized. As of Tuesday, September 29th, the total number of positive cases in Pecos County is at 267 people since the start of the pandemic. A total of 2,082 people have been tested, and of those tested, 1,712 have tested negative for COVID-19. That means 82 out of every 100 people tested have negative test results. State mandates are still in place to wear masks in public places and keep social distancing when possible. Halloween is a go for trick-or-treaters. Kids and their parents that live in Pecos County received good news on Thursday, September 24th, regarding Halloween. Trick-or-treaters will be able to go house to house in the county to collect candy and treats, according to County Judge Joe Schuster and Fort Stockton Mayor Chris Alexander. Schuster and Alexander announced the news on their weekly Facebook Live COVID-19 update on September 24th. What we decided was we feel like trick-or-treating can happen from our usual time, 6 to 9 p.m. We are asking everyone to keep a mask on, use the same rules that are in place now. Put a mask on your kids. If you're handing candy out, keep your mask on. If you're going to put a Halloween mask on, put a COVID mask below that, or decorate your COVID mask, Alexander said. What will not be able to happen is trunk or treat or Halloween carnivals due to the large gathering of people those events bring together. Neither one of those are a go for this year as of September 24th, according to Alexander. Halloween is on Saturday, October 31st this year. Pecos County People. Dominguez retires after 43 years with Pecos County State Bank, by Nathan Hewer. In August of 1977, Fort Stockton native Juanita Dominguez had an important decision to make regarding her career. Just a few years prior, Pecos County State Bank officer Joe A. Hernandez reached out to Dominguez to gauge her interest in an opening in the bank's note department. Dominguez decided at the time to stay with her job she had with a finance company. I thought about it and decided I wasn't ready to move on, she said. Fast forward 2 years, and Hernandez called again, this time regarding a job opening for secretary at the bank. Dominguez felt it was a time for a change and accepted the position, starting her job as the Pecos County State Bank's secretary on August 8, 1977. I thank Joe A. Hernandez, an officer at the bank at the time I began, for encouraging me to apply for the position at the bank, she said. The decision proved to be a career-defining one. Just 6 years after taking the secretary job with the bank, Dominguez applied to become a lender with the bank. The Fort Stockton native got the job, becoming the first female lender in the bank's history. I convinced Harlan Lambert to give this girl an opportunity to do the job. I'm sure he was hesitant, as no other female had ever held a lender's position in the bank's history. I certainly worked hard to prove I could do the job, Dominguez said. I always joked a bit with him that he made the best decision he ever made when he allowed me to be a lender. Dominguez will retire as the bank's senior vice president. Over the course of her 43-year career with Pecos County State Bank, the Fort Stockton native had the privilege of working with her sons, one of the fondest memories her time working for the bank. Pecos County State Bank has been a blessing to me and my family, as all my boys worked here, Dominguez said. I also give thanks for the opportunity to work here with my son, Eric, in the lending area. What a unique experience for us to have enjoyed together. Heading into retirement, Dominguez knows she needs a break, but also has mixed feelings when it comes to her new reality. I'm a worker. It's kind of a scary feeling. All of a sudden, I won't have a job. I've never not had a job, she said. The work atmosphere at the bank also didn't make it easy for Dominguez to retire. The Fort Stockton native said her job never really felt like work due to the joy it brought and those she worked with, as well as the customers. All this time it did not feel like work because I have enjoyed it greatly, and it has become a part of me. It has been a fun ride. I will miss it greatly and will miss all the people I have been blessed to know, she said. I give thanks to Pecos County State Bank, Harlan Lambert, Chairman of the Board George Hansard, President and CEO, the Board of Directors, and all the assistants I have had over the years, and all my other co-workers. Do something. Your guide to local places to go and things to do. If you have an event for our Do Something listing, please email nathan.hewer, H-E-U-E-R, at fortstocktonpioneer.com. Friday through Wednesday, October 16th through the 21st, Fort Stockton Community Theater will hold its next play, a reprise of The Odd Couple. The female version, written by Neil Simon and directed by Alice Dirksen, performed by special arrangement with Samuel French, Inc. Neil Simon's The Odd Couple entertained Broadway audiences as well as movie and television audiences. FSCT has delighted audiences with both the male and female versions of the play and is planning to again. Seating will be limited. Reservations will be required. Friday through Saturday, October 30th through the 31st, Horsehead Crossing Celebration, the Pecos County Historical Commission, PCHC, will commemorate the various historical figures who passed over this well-known crossing throughout the 16th through the 19th centuries, including the Comanche War Trail, the Emigrant Trail, the Butterfield Overland Stage, and the Goodnight Loving Trail, made famous by Larry McMurtry's Lonesome Dove. Town Hall Meeting Begins Process for New Rec Facility by Nathan Hewer. The City of Fort Stockton hosted a town hall meeting on Thursday, September 24th at the Northside Church in Fort Stockton to hear thoughts from the community on what they would like to have in a new recreational facility. City Council members Pam Pelileo, James Warnock, and Paul Casillas were all present at the meeting. Fort Stockton Mayor Chris Alexander, City Manager Frank Rodriguez, and Director of Recreation Ruby Bernal were also part of the panel that received feedback from the area residents. The meeting represented the beginning stage of a long process to build a recreational facility in the future in the Fort Stockton area. We've talked about this for quite a while. This is not a let's build this meeting. This is a let's get more input. Let's get more ideas and what everybody feels is needed, Fort Stockton Mayor Chris Alexander said. Community members had many commonalities in their desires for a recreational facility. The two items that came up the most in discussions were basketball, volleyball courts, and batting cages. Other ideas that came up were indoor baseball and soccer fields, weightlifting area, rooms for arts and crafts, and outdoor fields for various sports. County Judge Joe Schuster, who was an audience member, laid out a potential four-wing plan and how it would be done. I'm listening to everybody here. I think there's some good ideas and using those ideas to build facilities suitable for multi-purpose deals, he said. Schuster's four-wing plan only includes indoor facilities. The wings would be broken down into basketball, volleyball courts, batting cages, soccer fields, weightlifting room, racquetball courts, and a fourth wing that had yet to be determined. I got four wings. You could use one wing for volleyball and basketball. You could use another wing for indoor batting cages and during soccer season, taking the batting cages out and bring in and set up two indoor fields for soccer, Schuster said. Then you got another wing you could use for weights and aerobics, all in that one wing. That wing would go year-round. Also, you could use that wing for handball, racquetball courts in that same wing. The idea was one of many by audience members. Topics that were also addressed included a timeline on how long the process will be to get a new facility up and running, as well as the financial aspect of it. Fort Stockton City Manager Frank Rodriguez addressed both concerns, which many audience members asked about. Rodriguez said the beginning discussion surrounding a new recreation facility started around 2 years ago, and now the city is to a point where they are ready to get the ball rolling on the potential project, starting with Thursday's meeting. Now it's to the point where our guys are wanting to make things happen. What we decided to do was to hold this meeting, Rodriguez said. It's a multi-purpose facility. We're going to be smart about it. We're going to identify what we can start with and then build our way from there. The whole goal is not to build something and just have it looking pretty while not being utilized. All of that has been discussed. A time frame was not available for the project as there are many layers to the process that can vary greatly in time for getting done. I can't put a timeline on it. All I can tell you is tomorrow when I go to work, I'm going to start taking the information that we gather tonight and see what is the next step. Really, what it boils down to is the project design based off what we can do and how we can do it. Then the next thing is the price tag. So realistically, since we've got this far, we figure another 2 meetings, 3 meetings at the most, to make sure we hear everyone's input, Rodriguez said. After receiving input from the public, hear from on what they want the facility to have. Rodriguez will then reach out to architects and engineers. The financial aspect of the job was briefly discussed during the meeting. Schuster said the county would certainly be willing to contribute, but also iterated that it's important to be cost-effective as possible and to potentially do it in phases rather than all at one time. What we need is to figure out how much this is going to cost and how we're going to pay for it. We're talking a few $1 million, Schuster said. I'm in favor of doing something like this. I don't know where we're going to get the money, but I think the county would be willing to go in a venture like this together to come up with the money to build a facility for this community. To conclude the meeting, a slideshow was shown of Pecos' new recreation facility, which is currently being built. The price tag on the project in Pecos is over $18 million, according to Schuster, who has visited the facility a couple of times. The county judge emphasized the new one to be built in the Fort Stockton area will be far cheaper, but could include many aspects of what the facility in Pecos has. In Pecos, they spent over $18 million on their facility, he said. I don't know if that's what we want here. We'll build it a little more conservative and still come up with the same aspects. Rodriguez added there'll be multiple ways to fund the project, but there are many steps to go before getting to that point.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, October 1st. Chase nets 9 illegals, others at large. The story was written by John Fulbright and Christy Sullivan. A van containing about a dozen people believed to be in the U.S. illegally, a chase through the east side of Pecos and two dove hunters setting up in a field last Thursday, combined to cause the brief lockdown of Bessie Haynes Elementary amid reports of a gunfire incident. Pecos Police Chief Lisa Tarango said 9 persons were apprehended following the incident, which began around sunrise on September 24th, when a van failed to slow down for school zone warning lights in the 900 block of South Cedar Street. Quote, "It was initiated as a traffic stop, but when it became apparent the vehicle wasn't stopping, it became a pursuit," she said. The driver of the van turned east off Cedar on 5th Street and continued to the end of 5th at Martinez. The driver and the passengers in the van then attempted to flee, running east toward the Rancho Road area and from there into the field between Rancho and the Pecos River. Other law enforcement officers arrived to assist with the search, and 9 people were apprehended in the area. Ward County Sheriff Freyran Valle said, quote, "Deputies were called to assist the Pecos Police Department and other agencies in attempting to locate 12 to 15 undocumented subjects who fled from the Pecos Police Department after a vehicle pursuit, which ended at the east side of town, and the subjects were possibly running toward the Ward County line," end quote. Tarango said the lockdown at Bessie Haynes in the 800 block of East 11th Street was done due to reports of shots being fired, which turned out to have occurred because 2 dove hunters were in the same area at that time. Quote, "At first, the officers weren't sure if they were taking fire, but it turned out that they, the hunters, just happened to be in that area at that time," she said. Pecos EMS was called and were on standby near the area, but there were no injuries in connection with the incident. Along with police and Border Patrol officers, Reeves County Sheriff's Department deputies also participated in the search, while Pecos Fire Department trucks were used to block off streets between Rancho Road and Martinez Street while the search was underway, and Ward County deputies also were called to the area in case any of those who ran from the van made it across the nearby Pecos River. Tarango said the illegals who were apprehended were turned over to Border Patrol officers in the Marfa sector and were transported to their facility in Alpine. Commissioners discuss routine items. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. In a short meeting on Monday morning, the Ward County Commissioners approved the annual road reports from each precinct and declared certain equipment as surplus in Precinct 1. All road reports were submitted in writing to the court for consideration, declaring the condition of every county-supported road and estimated repair costs in each district by the respective commissioner. Roads are ranked by condition on a scale of 1 to 5, where 5 is considered excellent. The reports are an annual requirement in order for the county to receive additional funds from the state. All 4 reports were approved. Precinct 1 Commissioner Tito Sanchez stated $2 million would be needed to repair the roads in his precinct, along with an additional $2,500 for bridges and culverts. Most of the roads were rated as condition 1 to 3 and included county roads and some streets in Monahans that are not within the city limits. Precinct 2 Commissioner Larry Hanna estimated $30,000 in needed repairs. Most of the roads in Precinct 2 are within the city limits of Monahans and are the responsibility of the city. Precinct 3 Commissioner Dexter Nichols estimated $3.25 million. Most of the roads are south of Monahans along the South Highway 18 corridor to Grand Falls. Precinct 4 Commissioner Eddie Nelms estimated $3.5 to $3.8 million for roads and an additional cost of $300,000 for culverts and cattle guards. The majority of roads in the precinct are west and south of Monahans. Commissioners also approved the request of Sanchez to declare old Precinct 1 equipment as surplus or salvage. Included were several pickups, a water truck, and other powered equipment. The county will accept bids for the equipment. Approval for payment of bills totaling $2.4 million was unanimous. Commissioners present for the meeting were Larry Hanna, Dexter Nichols, and Eddie Nelms. Commissioner Sanchez was not present. County Judge Greg Holly also was in attendance. The next meeting of the commissioners will be held on October 12th at 9:30 a.m. in the commissioners' courtroom of the Ward County Courthouse at 400 South Allen Street. Monahan's veteran, who flew in three war campaigns, celebrates 98th birthday. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. Buford M. Humphreys celebrated his 98th birthday on September 20th. While that in itself is a great accomplishment, that is not the most extraordinary thing about this gentleman. The amazing thing is that he served in the United States military in World War II, the Korean conflict, and the Vietnam War. On December 7, 1941, Humphreys was on his lunch break at his job at the Greyhound bus station in Big Spring, listening to the radio, when the announcement came over the radio about the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor. A couple of months later, he joined the Army Air Corps and attended cadet school in San Antonio. That was the start of an almost 30-year military career that ended in 1971 as a colonel in the United States Air Force as the base commander at Whiteman Air Force Base in Missouri. Humphreys was born at home on a farm in West in McLennan County, Texas, in 1922. His dad was a farmer and his mother a schoolteacher. The family moved to Lockney, where his dad worked in a cotton oil processing plant. Later, the family moved to Littlefield, where he graduated in 1939. He then attended Hardin-Simmons College in Abilene before moving to Big Spring to work for Greyhound. After cadet training, Second Lieutenant Humphreys completed the requirements as an aerial navigator on July 3, 1943. He was deployed to the Pacific Theater of World War II. Initially, he was a navigator on a B-24 bomber of the 7th Air Force. Quote, "I wanted to be a pilot, but they said my eyesight wasn't good enough," he said. Before the days of modern electronics, celestial navigation was the primary method for navigating to the assigned targets. As the U.S. military swept across the Pacific Islands and retaking Japanese holdings in the island-hopping campaign, the bombers would follow. When the islands were secured and airfields established, the B-24 Liberators would follow and start bombing campaigns on the next targeted island. Quote, "We followed the island hopping and did bombing runs to Kwajalein Atoll, Tarawa, Canton, and others. It was determined that my eyesight wasn't that bad and I went to pilot school. By that time, I was a B-24 pilot for bombing missions over Iwo Jima," he said. He flew 70 combat missions in World War II. The B-24 Liberator bomber, built by Consolidated Aircraft, was infamously called the Flying Coffin at times. It was said that the square-shaped four-engine aircraft was hard to fly with stiff and heavy controls. the Liberators had only one exit near the tail, making it almost impossible for the crew to reach the rear from the flight deck while wearing a parachute. The B-24 was introduced in 1941, and 18,000 were built. After returning to the States, Humphreys was visiting a downtown officers' club in El Paso, where he met Dorothy. The couple hit it off and were married in June 1945. Their son Harrison was born in 1947, followed by twins Betty and Barbara in 1949. By this time, he had transferred to the United States Air Force after it was formed as its own branch of the military in 1948. The Korean conflict broke out in 1950, and Humphreys was again piloting bombers. But this time, it was as an aircraft commander on Boeing B-29 Super Fortress bombers as part of the Strategic Air Command. The aircraft commander, now in his late 20s with the rank of captain, flew 30 night bombing missions before being reassigned stateside. The B-29s had mostly been retired after World War II service, and many were pulled out of storage and refurbished and upgraded for service in the Korean War. Because of the advent of Soviet-built jet aircraft fighters, B-29 losses were high in the early goings of the conflict. As such, the bombers were restricted to night missions only. After returning to the States, Humphreys worked in Strategic Air Command staff positions. The Air Force sent him to the University of Texas to finish his degree, which had been started many years earlier at Hardin-Simmons. He completed his degree in 1957. During that time, the last of four children was born to Buford and Dorothy. Patricia was born in 1958. In the days before the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1963, he attended ballistic missile school. Although he was never directly involved in the crisis, quote, "It was a scary time. We didn't know if we were going to war or what was going to happen," he said. But his combat flying days were not over. When the Vietnam War broke out, he was again an aircraft commander, this time on a C-130 cargo plane. The ability to fly low and drop cargo made the aircraft vulnerable to ground fire, prompting Humphreys to say, quote, "I came closer to being shot down in Vietnam than either World War II or Korea," end quote. The Lockheed C-130 Hercules was a four-turboprop engine, high-wing aircraft designed for carrying cargo and troops. The aircraft had the ability to carry a payload of up to 76,000 pounds, which could be airdropped from a rear cargo door that could be deployed while in flight. After 30 Vietnam combat missions, he again returned stateside. He was promoted to colonel in 1967 and served as base commander at Whiteman Air Force Base, Missouri, until his retirement in 1971. Whiteman was a missile wing under the Strategic Air Command with the Minuteman intercontinental ballistic missile. Humphreys was not directly involved with the missiles as his duties as base commander dealt with operation of the base itself and not the armament. After retirement, he did not slow down. He worked for the state health department and was the owner of a small finance company. He was very active with kids in the community and coached baseball and golf. He and Dorothy later purchased an RV and traveled the country. Dorothy passed away in 1993. A few years later, Buford married Pauline in 1996. Quote, "She was my neighbor across the street," he said with a smile. Pauline passed away 4 years ago. He has made his home in Monahan since 2010. Buford dealt for several years with knee issues, and after five unsuccessful attempts at replacing the knee, his right leg was removed at mid-thigh. Quote, The infection got too bad, and there was no skin left, so there was no choice but to have the leg removed, he said. Until a recent stroke slowed him down, he was still doing gardening, his own laundry, and cooking. Quote, I'm good friends with Schwann's, he said with a smile, but the body will only accept so much, end quote. He still enjoys reading and playing cards. He is still the skip-bo champion, daughter Betty Turner said. Despite his afflictions, his sense of humor has not diminished, and his smile remains strong. PT renovation underway. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. Asbestos abatement for the physical therapy clinic is underway as the first step in the renovation of the clinic, Ward Memorial Hospital CEO Leticia Rodriguez told the Board of Managers in last Thursday's meeting. The removal of the asbestos will take 4 to 5 weeks, and the renovation, which has been contracted to M&W Builders, will begin after that and will take about a year. The PT clinic will move to temporary quarters in a manufactured building located behind the specialty clinic on the corner of 4th and Ike Street. The move was scheduled to get underway the week of September 28th. Because of the PT renovation, the biweekly meetings of the managers has been moved to the Ward County Event Center at 1525 East Monahans Parkway instead of the boardroom of the clinic until the renovation is complete. Managers present for the meeting were Dr. John Fawcett, Larry Hunt, Gerald Carlson, Jeff Burdick, Frank Heslin, Angel Fuentes, and Tommy Escamilla. Manager Lisa Stewart was not present. Here are some obituaries that appeared in the Monahans News on Thursday, October 1st. Samuel Leonard Burke of Monahans passed away on September 27th at the age of 94. Samuel Leonard Burke was born in Grannis, Arkansas on October 21, 1925, to Edgar Henry Burke and Rula Emma Burke. Sam moved to Monahans in 1935, where he resided until his death. He worked on and off in the oil field until he began his career as a mail carrier in the 1980s. Sam remained a mail carrier until he retired. Sam was preceded in death by his parents, Edgar Henry Burke and Rula Emma Burke, as well as his younger brother, Fred Burke. He is survived by his sister, Margaret Browning of Monahans, 3 nieces, Deborah Burke of Euless, Dana Hartigee of Clyde, and Diana Green and husband Ronnie of Dublin, 3 great-nieces, 2 great-great-nephews, and 1 great-great-niece. Graveside services were held on Tuesday, September 29th, at Monahans Memorial Cemetery, with Joshua Reef officiating. Visit our website, harkeyfunerals.com, to sign the guestbook or leave a personal note for the family. Funeral arrangements were under the direction of Harkey Funeral Home. Linda Deanne Mitchell of Brownwood, age 73, passed away on Thursday, September 24th, in Temple. Linda was born in Velasco to Orville Lyle Phillips and also May Katana Kennedy Phillips on Wednesday, September 24th, 1947. At the age of 9 months old, Linda's birth father, Orville Phillips, tragically passed away, and her mother later married J.M. Red Myers of Kermit, who raised Linda as his daughter. Linda was a graduate of the class of 1966 at Kermit High School in Kermit. Linda married Leonard Paul Kenyon on October 15, 1965, in Kermit, and together they were blessed with 2 sons, Brian and Lyle. Later in life, she married Robert Marion Mitchell on September 24, 1978, and Sanger. Linda is survived by her 2 sons, Brian Myers Kenyon and wife Camilla of May. Lyle Phillips Kenyon and wife Stephine of Princeton, Minnesota, sister Beverly Bug Jean Myers Crabtree of Kermit, brother John Arthur Myers of Kermit, brother-in-law Bill Mitchell of McKenzie, Tennessee, as well as three grandchildren and many nieces, nephews, family, and friends. Linda is preceded in death by her beloved husband of 18 years, Robert Marion Mitchell III, her birth father, Orville Lyle Phillips, her mother, Alta Mae Quintana Myers, her stepfather, J.M. Red Myers, and her sister, Paula Marie Myers Montgomery. Linda had requested no services or memorials to be held. In lieu of flowers or memorials, Linda and family have requested that donations be made to Kermit High School Class of 66 Linda Myers Scholarship Fund. A scholarship will be created by her classmates and awarded in her name to a future Kermit High School graduate that desires to pursue a degree in the profession she loved, cosmetology. Donations can be mailed to KHS Class of 66 alumni member Ronnie Walker, Post Office Box 9 in Canton, Texas, 75103, or donations can be sent electronically to Brian Myers Kenyon via PayPal at bkenyon69@yahoo.com or via Venmo at BrianKenyon-12. Online condolences can be made to the family at www.heartlandfuneralhome.net. Juan Garcia Olivas gained his wings and went peacefully to be with our Lord on Monday, September 28th. Juan was born in Colorado City, Texas, on January 19, 1940, to his parents, Angel and Elvira Olivas. He was a lifelong resident of Monahans. Juan is preceded in death by his parents, Angel and Elvira Olivas, brother Angel Olivas, infant sister Elida Olivas. He is survived by his wife of 62 years, Maria Socorro Olivas, brothers Pascual Olivas and wife Carmen of Monahans, Gomesindo Olivas and wife Delia of Lubbock, sisters Gloria Hernandez and husband Prajitas of Victoria, Anita Valencia and husband Severano of Monahans, and Enamel Cavazos and husband Joe of Crane, sons Johnny Olivas and wife Nellie of Marble Falls, Pascual Olivas and wife Cheryl of El Paso, daughters Elaine Fine and husband Steve of Monahans, and Dina Williams and husband David of Artesia, New Mexico, as well as several grandchildren, great-grandchildren, nieces, and nephews. Rosary for Juan Olivas was held on Wednesday, September 30th. Mass was held on Thursday, October 1st, with burial following at Monahans Memorial Cemetery. Funeral arrangements are under the direction of Harkey Funeral Home. Visit our website at harkeyfunerals.com to sign the guest book or leave a personal note for the family. Jean Marie Swan Bowling Stone, age 83, of Stephenville, entered her heavenly rest on September 24th in Stephenville. Jane was born on February 19, 1937, to the late Albert S. and Lily Ewell Swan in Dickens County. She attended grade school in Dickens, and the rest of her education was in Afton. Jane married Bobby Ralph Bowling on October 25, 1953, at the Swan home in Dickens, and made their home in Monahans for 24 years. They had five children. In 1977, they moved to San Angelo and later to Dublin, where they both retired after working for the U.S. Postal Service. Bob preceded her in death on May 4, 1989. On July 25, 1993, Jane married Elvis S. Runt Stone in Dublin. Runt preceded her in death on May 3, 2019. She was also preceded in death by her parents, Albert and Lily Mae Ewell Swan, two infant sons, husband Bob Bowling, son-in-law Joe Pruitt, granddaughter Jana Bowling, four brothers and three sisters, and husband E.R. Brent Stone. Survivors for Jane include children Rhonda Hooper and husband Danny of Argyle, Beverly Pruitt of Skiatook, Oklahoma, Len Bowling and wife Jaxine of San Angelo, Lori Gillespie of Stephenville, Lily McGrath and husband Kenneth of Angleton, Ray Stone and wife Glenda of Stephenville, Rick Stone of Stephenville, Mike Stone and wife Pam of Stephenville. She is also survived by 15 grandchildren and 21 great-grandchildren, one brother and two sisters, as well as many nieces and nephews. Funeral services were held on Tuesday, September 29th, at Stephenville Funeral Home Chapel, with Len Bowling officiating. Burial followed at Gardens of Memory Cemetery in Stephenville. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions can be made to Foster's Home for Children in Stephenville, Texas, Alzheimer's Association, Leukemia Research Foundation, or a charity of choice. Online condolences may be made at www.stephenvillefh.com. Janelle Ida Lloyd Llewellyn, age 83, of Odessa, passed away the morning of Thursday, September 17th. Janelle Ida Lloyd was born in Wagoner, Oklahoma, on December 24th, 1936. She was the daughter of Raymond Cass Lloyd and Lenora Cummins Lloyd. Her father was a county agent in northern Oklahoma. Janelle earned her bachelor's degree from Oklahoma A&M, now known as Oklahoma State University. While at college, she married the love of her life, William Bill J. Llewellyn, in 1957. Janelle was preceded in death by her husband, William J. Llewellyn, father, Raymond Cass Lloyd, mother, Lenora Cummins Lloyd, sister, LaVon Sutton, and brother, Eddie Lloyd. Janelle is survived by son, Raymond Llewellyn, and his wife, Deborah Llewellyn, of Monahans, daughter, Rhonda Llewellyn, of Odessa, two grandsons, five great-grandchildren, a sister, Carol Douglas, and her husband, Ben Douglas, of Stillwater, Oklahoma, brother-in-law, Earl Sutton, of Stillwater, Oklahoma. In lieu of flowers, please consider donations to St. Jude's Connection Christian Church of Odessa or the Dr. Abdul Qadir Stroke Center of Excellence through the MCHS Foundation.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.